Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Inside College Soccer again. I'm your host, Don Williams, and I'm here with, almost call him my co-host. He's been on three or four or five different episodes with us, but he's my main man, Andre Luciano, out here on the West Coast with me. He's in Vegas while I'm over in California. Hey, Andre, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. Right on. I know you don't have long today because I think you're getting ready to hop on a plane and head out. Where are you headed to?
Heading out to San Diego for Surf Cup. Always a great event and one of my favorite locations to go to. But been on the road a lot this summer, and this is going to kind of cap off the probably one of the final events before the fall season starts.
My record was 21 out of 30 days. I think you beat that by quite a bit. You've been how much you've been on the road this last summer?
It's been quite a bit. I'm not going to lie.
Every time I talk to you, the other day I tried to call you and you said, "Oh, I'm at the Indiana camp." I said, "Oh, dang, I forgot." But it's hard to catch you when you're not on the road. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the job, right? So a lot of days on the road, and in the fall will be a little bit slower when everybody's seasons, get online and collegially. So it'll slow down a little bit.
So Andre, in a former life for about 20 years, I also did people's income taxes. And so I always look forward to that window where everybody's taxes were filed pretty much. And you were done and you get that downtime. The only time I get that now in our job with SRUSA is like, I love when the season starts, man. Things slow down a lot in August and September, and coaches don't want to talk to anybody. They just want to win. They just want to focus on winning.
Yeah, they just want to focus on our teams and their visits on campus. So, yep, exactly. Gotcha.
So we're almost there, brother. We're almost there. So, Andre, you and I have really not known each other relatively that long, considering we were both West Coast guys, right? We were just a state away, roughly the same age. I'm a little older. I'm 61. You're still a young 50-something, right?
I'm not going to disclose my age.
Oh, look at you with your vanity. I noticed that those lines on your forehead have gone away.
Did you get some hair? It's just the sun.
Lips are looking a little puffier. Don't go too West Coast on us. You've been spending a lot of time.
No, that's just being healthy.
No, but considering we both coached women's soccer for 20 years on the West Coast and we had never met, but I was in the D2 world, of course, and you were in the D1 world. But yeah, our paths never crossed, and then Ernie introduced us, I think, right?
Well, I think you and I crossed paths when you were still at Feather River and I was at Northern Arizona. So you and I had connected at an event. We were talking about junior college, and we started talking about how I was a JUCO byproduct and how much respect I have for junior colleges. And that's how I think you and I initially got connected.
And then, funny, I'd forgotten all about that one.
Yeah. And I think Ernie connected us when I was done with coaching in college and you were asking like, "Hey, can you connect me with somebody at this conference?" And I said, "Yeah, let me get that number for you." So that's how we kind of connected on this side of things.
You got a memory like my wife does, man. I don't remember any of that. but I remember you getting out of the game, right? I remember you, or at least no, not getting out of coaching, but you had left Northern Arizona, right? Settling back in Vegas.
Yeah, it was time. You know, it's been 25 years coaching on the women's side, and then I spent some time before doing other things. And
where were you at before NAU? Where were you? So
my coaching journey started at Indiana as an undergrad assistant, and then I was asked to go to Washington State. So I worked at Washington State for 3 years, and then I took some time off, did some skiing, and got into it, back into it at Utah State for a season and a half, and then Arizona called, And I went to the University of Arizona, and I was there from, I think, 99 through March of 2001. And I spent, almost like, I think it's full 18 years at NAU. So long enough. And it was time. I was tired. It was time to get out of a Flagstaff and to come home and be around family and friends. And it's all worked out great.
Right on. And you were, you started at Indiana, you said, as a grad assistant. That's because you played there, right?
Yeah. So I was there 91 through 93. And then I had to finish my degree because I had left to try to play pro. That didn't work out. So I came back and got my degree and it was awesome. That was like a really great experience playing for Jerry Eglie and that program, and really thankful for everything that they gave me and all the opportunities and friendships, and just being a part of this wonderful family, this IU family was really great. And, gave me some insight in terms of what high level collegiate athletics was all about, having come from a junior college before that.
Yeah, that's a pretty crazy story, Andre, because I don't know how many. I mean, I had a kid go from junior college to Notre Dame, right? But there's not a ton of kids that are capable of making that move successfully and playing in this country, whether it's from high school to Indiana or whether it's from junior college to Indiana. I think most junior college kids end up going somewhere else if it's not Indiana. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, all the planets were aligned the right way, and so IU had just graduated Jurgen Summers. He was leaving. That was his final season was the 1990 season. And he was leaving to go to England to play pro. And I think, they had a couple guys on the roster, but had not had a lot of experience, a lot of games experience. And so they didn't really feel like they had a good line on a freshman, like a true freshman coming in that could come in and be an impact right away. So they wanted somebody with some game experience. And, I had gone to Yavapai, and we had this unbelievable run in 2 years. We lost one game in 2 years, and we won a national title within the first 2 years of the program. And at the national championships, I was named goalkeeper of the year, Adidas goalkeeper of the year, and it just worked out because I had taken a gap year. I was a little bit older, and so when I went to IU, I'm trying to think. Let's see, 1991. So I was 22 years old by the time I got to, to IU, and so they had a massive freshman class coming in, so they kind of needed a stopgap, I think. And they just needed someone with some in-game experience and who maybe would not be rattled, in terms of being in a big setting. And I just really had an incredible visit with Coach Yeagley, and just felt a connection right off the bat that, he's like my dad right now. So it was just a great visit, a great experience. And I didn't even know who he was. I mean, honestly, like I had no concept of college soccer. I was just playing college because I didn't want to work, like my parents never really prepared me for college. Never
talked about it. You grew up in Vegas, right? Or at least your high school years in Vegas.
Yeah.
Right?
I grew up in Vegas, and I thought, natural progression. And I went to a really, we played for a really successful high school program that had won like, four state titles in a row. And a coach that had done really well. And
you thought you were going to high school, huh?
Well, yeah, I thought I was going to play at UNLV. That was like my thing. So okay. Harry Fields graduated from Chaparral High School, was a goalkeeper, played at UNLV. Danny Anderson, played at Chaparral High School, went straight to UNLV. I got trained by Danny. I played for the same club team. And back then he was only, really two teams in Vegas, an East Side team and a West Side team. And it just didn't materialize that way. I was skinny. I was 155, 6 foot, I don't know, one back then. But my GPA wasn't great. By the time when I was at IU, I was 165. That was it. So right. I was just a quick, wiry kid. But wow. I just physically wasn't there. UNLV told me I wasn't a Division I player. They didn't feel that way, and they were right at the time. They were right, and my GPA was awful. I had like a 2.74 my last
Okay.
I didn't even take the ACT, so like it just wasn't in my wheelhouse to even think about college, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, I took a gap year. You know, I played on a good men's league team, Limon here in Vegas, good competition. And I just got lucky because I had a referee named John Kennedy and my high school coach, just gave a reference to Mike Pantaleone at Yavapai, who was starting the program in 89, you know. So in 88, he's like, when I graduated in 88, I didn't know where I was going to go. And so I took that gap year. And then literally that spring of 89, Mike came out to a game, a men's league game, and just walked up and said, "Hey, I'm starting a program. You know, are you interested?" And, you know, I tell the story all the time. I say, you know, Mike will tell you. It's like, yeah, whatever. Took his brochure and threw it away. And then trying to, you know, my vanity, right? Like I'm not going to go to junior college. And so, you know, you kind of do some self-reflection, and a couple of buddies of mine from Vegas were going to go there. And I'm like, you know what? I might as well go. So took a visit, and no team, no fields, you know, no history whatsoever. Basically coming on as a walk-on, and it worked out awesome. Like that whole experience was awesome. It just clicked, and we were really good right off the bat. Our first game we played, I believe it was Forest Park, who were defending national champions, and we beat them 4-3. And so it kind of just put, you know, put that those wheels in motion, going that junior college route. And that's why, you know, I'm such a big JUCO advocate, you know, because it provided me so many different opportunities, and it laid out so many different foundations. And what was great was, like, you know, once you start college, you start with a 4.0, right? And so you start college with a 4.0, and it gave me the ability to have just this massive hard reset academically. And the environment was a little bit smaller, and the professors, you know, they would call your hallway phone, like, "Hey, how come you're not in class?" And like, you sprint over, you know, and go to class. And so it taught me, you know, accountability and having to be a little bit more focused on, you know, not just getting a 2.0, but having a standard academically, which was great. And it changed my life, you know, and I have so much pride, you know, being in that Hall of Fame, being in the National Junior College Hall of Fame. You know, there's so many different things that came out of that experience of taking a risk, taking a chance on something that wasn't even established. And it led me to, you know, IU, and then it led me to this, you know, 27 seasons coaching in college, and to the point where I am now. So there's a lot to be said for being open to everything. That is something I stress all the time. And you know, you create your own paths, right? And so you got to figure that out. But yeah, so that's the long version of why you and I connected the first time, because of junior college coaches. Yep.
Yeah, and we're both JUCO products all through and through, and so we've seen the value of it and seen a lot of lives change through it. That's very
cool. Yeah, for sure.
That takes you up to SRUSA. So you and I sat down. Why? What made you decide to do this?
Well, I was doing this. Well, I mean, if you remember, I was doing this, you know, beforehand. I had made so many connections over the years traveling overseas, and I had all these academy directors, like gap year academy directors that had American kids. They started contacting me saying, "Hey, now that you're done with coaching, can you help us get some of these American kids back home because they're not going to be pros?" And I'm like, "Yeah, let me see what I can do." And you know, I started working with some kids and educating them and contacting coaches, and I got some kids placed. But I was coaching club here in Vegas, and you and I had connected, and you said, "Hey, can you help me, you know, with a couple of these kids?" And then, you know, two or three became, you know, a couple, but COVID happened, right? So COVID happened, and then things dramatically changed, because I went back to my alma mater, you know, Yavapai, because my coach, Mike, decided to retire because of COVID. And so I was not able really to work full time in this capacity, because I started coaching again. And then when I got out, when COVID was over, well, when it slowed down, I got back out, moved back to Vegas. And you said, "Hey, why don't you start doing this a little bit more full time?" And it's been good. You know, it's been a good transition. I feel like it's a natural transition. And, you know, full disclosure, you know, like I always talk about this, how I really wasn't a big, you know, a big recruiting agency fan, you know, back in the day as a college coach, because I just knew how some people operated. And I said, if I'm going to do this, and you and I had this discussion, I said, if we're going to do this, you and I are going to work together. I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to be on the road a lot. I'm going to be present. I'm going to go watch. I'm going to treat this as if I was a college coach. And that's where, you know, my connection with you and speaking with Chris Cousins, and I just felt like it was a little bit different, and I wanted to bring some more value to the company if I could.
You've done that for sure. I've learned a lot from you. Our staff has learned a lot from you. You brought a lot of experience, and I think you've brought a standard to the company of this is how we should operate, and how we can be different. You talk about that a lot. You mentioned that a lot to me. How can we be different? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know, I just remember talking to someone once, and they're recommending a player, and I'm like, have you ever seen this kid play? And they're like, no. Have you ever seen us play? No. I'm like, so how can you recommend this kid to me if you don't know what our level is, if you don't know what their level is, you haven't really evaluated in person what their you know, what their athleticism is, you haven't really watched that much film, you don't have much film on this kid. You haven't asked people who this kid is, what their personality is like, what their character is like. You know, this is, you know, there's being a college coach is hard. And so a lot of this is, you know, based on trust and having people trust your evaluation. And I think what I like is the fact that we have people that have worked at all different levels, right? And so you've got people that have worked Division I, Division II, Division III, NAIA, junior college. And you have people that have played at all different levels. I mean, we've got coaches that have won national titles, you know, in their coaching career. So I like the fact that we can bounce ideas off of each other, but also we can ask, you know, hey, can you do me a favor? Can you look at this kid and tell me what your thoughts are? And I think that's what's different is that, you know, what I want to do always is I never want to put a coach in a situation where that player is going to be a problem for them long term, because I've been there, you know, I know. And so, you know, things that I know that, you know, as a college coach, if you know, not everybody's always, I used to say this, it was a joke that I had, is like being a college coach was like being a sad clown, you know, like your intentions are good, and you know, but you can't make everybody happy. And I understood that, you know, and you know, I always talked about to the players, like, look, there's 990 total minutes in a game, and not everybody's going to get the same piece of the pie, you know, and not everybody's going to be happy. And my job now is to try to figure out how can I minimize those players that are unhappy with the situation that they're in. So I always talk about, you know, my job is 25%. Evaluating a player. I think evaluating a player is easy. I do. You know, if you know, you know. 50% is really educating the players and the families about the process and what it's really going to entail. And then 25% is just knocking on doors and trying to open the doors for the players. And once a door is open, it's not up to me to force a coach to take a player. It's like, hey, here's an introduction. You tell me what you think. And once it starts, I kind of back out because I don't want to feel like I'm being pushy to a college coach. So, you know, I think when we kind of create that environment for both the players and then the coaches know, like, hey, he's not pushing a kid. I think, you know, it just ends up being better, you know, and especially now, the way the, you know, the NCAA and the changes that are coming down the pipeline, so much is changing for the college coaches, and for recruiting as well. I think that the more I'm on the road, and that's the joke that we, you and I have, is like, you know, Allison's probably going crazy because you're never home. I have to know what's going on with what's happening. It's why, you know, I go back to the IU camps because it's great. You know, it's my network, it's my family. But there's also 30 different coaches there, and a lot of Division I, Division II, and Division III coaches there. So to sit around and kind of talk about what's happening, what's coming down the pipeline, what's the trends. it's really invaluable information to get, right? And so a lot of the stuff that I'm doing on the sideline, you know, it's not just getting feedback on the players, but also getting feedback from the college coaches, like, you know, this is, you know, yeah, this kid's good, you know, where does she or he fit into this? But when they start telling me like, hey, this is coming down the pipeline, you just need to know and just need to be aware of this, and you hear it often enough, then right. you can start giving some heads up to some families that they're not getting from the club coaches, or the college coaches are not telling them that because they're still recruiting them. But it's an ever evolving landscape, college athletics, but it is like 100 miles an hour. The rapids are moving fast, right? And no one knows what's really going on. And there's really not that much guidance, you know, being told to these coaches. They just don't know.
It's funny. There's been more change in the last 18 months than there was in the past 18 years.
Yeah. It's crazy.
You knew you could depend on how college soccer was going to run for forever. I could have told you everything. And now things are changing so rapidly that it is important, as you said, to be on the front lines. And I think that's, I know we're always messaging each other about that as a staff, what's going on, keeping each other abreast. Because, yeah, we do hear stuff from different sources.
I just think about how hard it is for college coaches right now, because they don't even know what's going on. Their administrators don't even know what's going on. The conferences don't even know what's going on. The NCAA doesn't know what's going on. No. And so everybody's operating in this gray. And right. all you can do is kind of speculate one way, or is it going to go this way, or is it going to go this way? And I feel for the coaches. I know the families, you know, are really frustrated, like, oh, this and that. But what I do think is we talk a lot about how the men have a much slower recruiting timeline and process, right? Because it just operates different. I really do feel that on the women's side, things, the brakes are going to get pumped really, really hard. And a hard pivot's going to be made, because there's some changes coming that are going to make coaches really think about what they're doing in terms of recruiting. And the aspect of retention is going to be, I think it's going to be a big topic of conversation, because I think a lot of kids are going to find out that, you know, I don't know if I fit into this mold of what the NCAA is going to give this program or these divisions, you know? And so, There's a lot coming, you know, and a lot of it's speculative, but there is, I think people kind of know where it's going. They just don't know exactly how many lanes it's going to be on those paths, right?
And I can almost guarantee how it affects the women is going to be different than how it affects the men. There's going to be different outcomes on each path.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes down to, I think, the revenue distribution, right? The revenue sharing, the distribution of it, the P4s, I think, are going to be very different than the mid majors, and, you know, the even FBS versus FCS, you know, schools are going to be affected very differently. And then even those FBS schools that are not on Power Fours, you know, how they get, and then they're trying to sort out, you know, like, you know, how does Title IX get affected by this? I mean, there's some conferences, you know, commissioners and people in different conferences that are saying, you know, absolutely, this is football and basketball revenue. You know, that TV revenue should go towards making that even stronger. And then those universities trying to figure out, can a university tap into university funds to balance out the Title IX aspect of it? It's just, there's a lot that's going into this, and there's a lot of unknowns. And it's, you know, whether or not people can get compensated, you know, for the revenue share, how much. And you're right, I don't think that the men's Olympic sports are going to, you know, benefit the way some other people think. You know, it's just, there's a lot of craziness. But I mean, that's the fun part of my job, right? Also is to kind of get to know what's happening and be on the forefront of it. But I do agree though, Don, that the day and age of like, hey, let's just email coaches nonstop is going to stop. Like, it's not going to stop, but I think that era of like, that's how you're going to get recruited is going to be significantly different, because I think coaches are going to be a little bit more of like, hey, I'm going to go after the well, right? I think the top kids in the country are going to get sorted out really fast. and then everybody else is going to be a little bit slower, because if they do go into headcount, you know, if it goes into headcount instead of equivalency sports, meaning that everybody gets on a full, I don't think college coaches are going to be so quick to put a full on a kid that they're not sure of.
Well, especially when you combine it with what we have been told 100% is coming, roster caps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the numbers are going to be, you know, numbers are, you know, anywhere from 26 to 30 or 26 to 28. Nobody really knows. But if that's the way it goes, you know, I was at a mid-major for 18 years. You know, going from 12 scholarships to 14 scholarships, that was like a big deal. Going from 12 to 25 scholarships or 14 to 25, I don't know. And I think some of these power fours, you know, they're going to be able to do it. I'm not really sure how the mid-majors are going to handle that. And how that's going to play out long term.
I've suspected that there'll be a number of schools that'll just say, forget it, we'll just go D2. Not going to fight this anymore.
Yeah, but you know, I also think that there's a marketing opportunity for schools. If you're a Division I program, statistically they show that there's a higher probability that your enrollment will be higher than if you're a Division II school, right? There's just like this perception that people have that. And so I think maybe to that point, Don, of like, hey, you know, the NCAA, and I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but I always felt like it could go this way, is that the NCAA might have to say, look, you know, we're not going to hold you to the 16 sports to be a Division I program. And now you pick and choose which sports you're going to support as Division I, Division II, and Division III within your own athletics department. And then you pick and choose, you know, like maybe this is just me in theory, just thinking out loud, like if you're Division I, your headcount, if you're a Division II sport, you're an equivalency. If you're Division III, there's no scholarship. And then the athletic department start kind of picking that out. I think that could be something that is considered. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I really, rather than dropping sports, I really hope that they allow that kind of flexibility, because that would be a shame that that sports are getting dropped to save budgets. You know, nobody wants to see that.
You know, I've heard you mentioned this idea before, and I always thought it was a good idea. And then I thought, oh, you know what the problem is, though? Title IX, because then a school could just go, all right, men's basketball, Division I, men's football, Division I, women's basketball, Division III. If they can pick and choose their sport, and then women's soccer, Division III, and then men's this, they could, and then somebody's going to get sued that you can't, because we don't want to spend.
But I really think if you look at the, I don't think that the women's sports are really going to get impacted as much. I tend to agree. I think there's going to be a balance. There's always going to be a need to balance. And if you look at Title IX for what it is, you know, it's gonna help in terms of keep that stability on the women's side. What I really worry about is the male Olympic sports, you know, and in a lot of places, you know, like the, you know, the equivalency sports, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's really where the danger comes in. And, you know, like what happens with the roster cut? You know, like there's some programs that carry, you know, 50 players. Like, yeah, you know,
80. Yes.
Well,
that's Division I, though. How many Division I's carry 50 on the men's side? How many?
I don't know, but that's what I, you know, think about is like those heavy, high roster programs. You know, those kids are going to have to go somewhere, or they're not going to go anywhere.
40 is not an unusual number to see on the men's side. 40 is not a strange number to see. So where do those 10 kids go, or 15 kids go, times all those schools? Yeah, they got to go somewhere else, huh?
Yeah, I feel like the transfer portal is going to be, oh man, that's going to get inundated when these numbers come out. And I think they said someone told me that it's probably going to be in the wintertime. They'll come up with some kind of a number or something like that. But I really feel like that number is going to balloon out of control in the transfer portal. And, but you know, part of this is also for families and kids to be open to look at all options, you know, like don't just get caught in Division One. And so what, you know, what might be the general thought process of every player that you talk to is like, I want to go to Division One. You're like, why not Division Two? Why not Division Three? And I think people are going to be open to it a little bit more if they know there's a cap on rosters, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's just, there's no room. There's just no room. You know, like, here's my analogy. I'd say, you know, like you go into a parking structure and they've got the little red light and, you know, green lights, and they say there's zero spots in level one. You either keep circling around until you find a spot and you waste a lot of time doing that, or you kind of just kind of come up and just go, you know what, I'm going to go to level two, level three, and there's more parking spots. You know, I'm going to park my car. I'm going to start, you know, I'm going to go shopping or go to the movie and not waste all my time doing this. It's, you know, it's the same parking spot, just the one floor higher. I think it's going to have to come down to that at some point in time. Some families are going to have to realize that there's just not enough parking spots.
That's funny. I love that analogy, because I had an ex-girlfriend's dad that we always made fun of, because he'd drive around the lot for 20 minutes to be able to park in front of the store.
Yeah, that was my dad. My dad was like that. And we're like, he used to drive a big Lincoln. And I'm like, they try to fit into tightest spaces. And I'm like, we're just wasting time finding this. Something will open up. And then we end up, at the end of the day, we end up, you know, everybody's fighting in the car, and we end up parking in the second level, third level anyway. So
that's great. Good analogy, Andre. It's going to be changing, and we'll stay on top of it. And I don't want to keep you too long here, because I know you got to hit the road. So you'll spend what's today? What is today? Thursday. So you're down there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Okay.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I mean, I think the summer has covered pretty much every major platform and every tournament. You know,
where have you been? Quickly, can you list off where you've been?
Well, I mean, the month of June, I was I did GA, DPL, ECNL girls, ECNL boys. Let's see, I'm doing Surf Cup. I was at camp in Indiana. May, I had a couple events in May. I mean, and then this, you know, I mean, this week is this week you got the boys playing in Richmond. And I've got four of my guys playing. I think the final is over. I haven't even figured out what the final was, but they were playing there. And I was asked, like, hey, are you gonna go? I'm like, man, I can't. I gotta have a little pause for at least 2 days to catch a breath. But one of the things that I really like is, you know, like us traveling overseas and checking out different academies and different things that because we do have some kids overseas in gap year academies, and that's been really good for some kids, you know, because the opportunity to grow as a person overseas, you can see some kids just maturing differently, right? Yes. And mm-hmm. getting, like, a couple of my boys from Vegas that went over there for just even 3 months, you know, they were at Malaga City just for 3 months. I said, how was it? And they're like, the level of play is so much higher and the expectations are so much higher. And, you know, the training habits and the level of professionalism, everything. And it was good, you know, it was good for them. And for some guys, you know, to be there for a full year, it's been really helpful. And had I had that opportunity coming out of high school in Vegas, and, you know, I could afford to do that, I would have done that on a heartbeat, you know, and just be a little bit more cosmopolitan, a little bit more polished, a little bit more worldly. I think for some of the kids, it's been really great. And that's one of the things I've really enjoyed working with SRUSA has been the opportunity to go overseas and see some of our kids that are in different academies and make connections with different academies and different people. And that's been good. And hopefully continue doing that. And, you know me, I like to travel internationally. So having lived everywhere, you know, lived overseas, that's been always one of my favorite things.
Well, I always say our job is actually quite simple. It's just to help kids that really love soccer continue to play after high school. That's it. And then chase whatever their pathway is. And the gap year thing is just another extension of that. For the kids that need help. I mean, we're just trying to figure out what the right fit is for them, right?
Yeah. And, you know, like one of the things I've been telling kids and families, been thinking about this, I watch a lot of Formula One, right? Because Allison gets up at 5:30 to watch these races. And so I started watching a lot of it. And how I describe it is that each individual player is a driver, right? They are the driver in this, and it's not the family. It's the family is the team sponsor, right? They're putting the money in, they're sponsoring the car. The player is the driver, and every driver has a specific skill set that makes them unique and different. The car is their technical, tactical, physical, that's the car. Their coaches, their trainers, their academic advisors, that's like the engineers and the mechanics that are working on the car, making sure it's fine tuned. And I'm just a guy in the headset. That's, hey, listen, it's a tight turn. I don't know. You might want to go bank outside, try to pass it on the outside, or you got two or three cars ahead of you right now. You know, you're not on the board. You're not in the top two of their board. And just providing like advice and communicating and saying, hey, you know, hey, listen, your wheels, your GPA are not where it needs to be. You know, we're going to have to kind of back off and change this. So that's what I feel like my job is just to provide really sound advice for these families, so they don't go into a heavy debt situation if they can't afford it, just to pursue the idea of playing soccer, Division One, when there are so many other opportunities out there, right? If you want to play and you're just getting a general degree, fine. You know, don't come out of college with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt just to say that you're a Division One player and your first 2 years you sat the bench, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense. And so some families, they have it set. They're like, hey, we're all good. You know, wherever they want to go, it's perfect. But I think that just giving people a real like reality check too, you know, and people don't like hearing, you know, what they need to hear sometimes, which is, I think, the hardest part of our job is like when you tell them like, look, this is based on my experience. And they're like, well, how do you know? I'm like, well, because we got smacked by Portland 7-0 back in the heyday when Sinclair and Rapinoe and all those players were there. I know, I've been there. You're not that player. I've played at that level. I know what that level is like. Or, you know what? This is a good level for you. This is a good fit for you. You just have to be patient. So I think that's what people forget is that, you know, there's a lot of advice on social media. There's a lot of advice all everywhere.
Yes, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. And you know, there's good advice and there's some advice. Some people are just being, you know, they just like to be confrontational, I guess, in some things. And, you know, and you're looking to get clicks and things like that, I guess, but there's a lot of advice. And I think being able to provide people good, solid advice based on experience is good. And sometimes, honestly, like it's just me being on the road, like I am this weekend, I've got five kids that I work with, go watch them and say, hey, this was good. This needs to be fixed. You know, you're going to go to camp next week on the East Coast for these schools. I would fix this. I would make this a priority for you. Is giving them that kind of feedback and advice. And you can't do that on, you know, just by going on social media and things like that. You just sometimes have to get that context, right? That one-on-one context and evaluation. And I feel like I do a good job. You know, it's never 100%, you know, nothing in life is, but I feel like I honestly try to do a really good job and try to be a good, good mentor for these kids as well.
Well, I can tell everybody out there that might be listening to this, it's what I've observed. It's because you give a crap. It's because you care about these kids and the families. You become, they become, you know, part of your network, and you build relationships with people. And that's just what you do. I've noticed two things about you that you're, one of them is, I didn't know your GPA was that bad in high school. It doesn't reflect what you are, which is you are an intellectual.
I had two priorities.
You speak seven languages, man. You speak seven languages. How many people I've never met in my life have ever spoke seven languages? Very few. So that you really do bring this piece to the puzzle of an intellectuality, and then that, and you do have a big heart. You get a very, very big heart, and it shows in the work that you do.
I appreciate that. I just I just want kids to fulfill their academic goals, because the professional path, I know everybody likes to chase the professional path and have these. But I also know that there's so much more, you know, your identity and it's hard, right? Because you and I have been coaches for a long time and been around the game. I just really want to help kids understand that there's a lot more to them instead of just their soccer identity, right? Like, what's your soccer identity? Your soccer doesn't define who you are, right? It's a small piece of that big pie. And the goal for me is always like, look, there's a lot more out there than just soccer.
Right.
So it's a big world and there's a lot of different people. And if I'm able to provide a little bit of that, then I've done my job. Right. And, I do like helping people. And I think you like helping people as well. And I think a lot of people that I work with also feel the same way. And, you know, it's not just a number for, it's just not a number. It's just, you know, I truly want people to be successful. So
brother, all right, talk to you soon. This is
all right.
It's been good. Thanks, Andre. Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Buddy. Appreciate it. Bye. Bye.